Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, extreme drought and high heat has gripped Texas. How bad could it get? And a former TV weatherman, Clovio Perez, runs for Congress with the platform of taking on climate change now. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Triple-digit temperatures and prolonged drought conditions are taking a toll on crops and livestock across the state. Statewide reports indicate that crop yields for all major Texas crops, including cotton, corn, sorghum, and wheat, are lower this year compared to last year. Crop yields in the Coastal Bend area are now 30 to 50% lower than normal. In central Texas, the Lower Colorado River Authority has cut off water shipments to downstream farmers in order to preserve supplies within the Highland Lakes. Also, water supplies for towns and cities are dipping dangerously low. Mandatory water conservation restrictions are in place for many municipalities across the state. Some communities, like the city of Gunther, are imposing emergency restrictions. Texas leadership needs to recognize that this could be the start of a multi-year mega drought, which would reshape Texas. That's according to Jeremy B. Mazur. He is a senior policy advisor for the nonprofit Texas 2036.
Yeah, my name is Jeremy Mazur. That's spelled M-A-Z-U-R. And I am a senior policy advisor here at Texas 2036.
What is Texas 2036?
Texas 2036 is a nonpartisan, nonprofit, data-driven organization working on long-term solutions for our state. Our North Star is to make Texas the best place to work and live by the time of our bicentennial, which is in year 2036.
Okay. Well, I sure hope we make it.
14 years ago, we can do it.
I'm not that confident. I want to talk about what people are calling the flash drought that we're facing in Texas right now. And the dwindling water supplies, the impact on agriculture, the higher risk for wildfires, more wildfires. What are you seeing in terms of this flash drought? Are you familiar with the term flash drought? Is that something that you use?
Yes. Yeah, David, a little bit of background. I've been working on water policy for the last 20 years, principally in the state legislature. But I've also served as Director of Government Relations for the Texas Water Development Board, the state's leading water planning and financing agency. So I have a lot of familiarity with regard to water trends and policy. With regard to the term flash drought, I am familiar with this term. However, I would beg to differ that I don't think the drought we're seeing now is necessarily a flash drought. A flash drought is typically a span of 3 or 4 weeks just without any rain. And while we've certainly not had much rain in central Texas, at least over the past three or four weeks, for the past year, this drought has been brewing in Texas. I was looking earlier at some data from the U.S. Drought Monitor, and I was looking at the drought map for Texas about a year ago from today, July 27th, 2001. Back in July 27th, 2001, 1 year ago and 1 day ago, 1 year and 1 day from today, only 1% of Texas, 1% was in moderate drought. Fast forward to today, and over 60% of the state is in the extreme to exceptional drought category. And when I've been looking at the maps and the data, this drought essentially started last October, grew throughout the fall, and has been growing all year. And so this is like the culmination of a year-long drying trend where it's gotten to a point where 60% of the state is in the exceptional to extreme drought category. But also more importantly, nearly 100% of the state is either in drought or just very dry. There's only one area of the state right now, surprisingly, it's El Paso, that doesn't have any drought conditions.
So it's not just the drought, but it's also the prolonged heat with the 100-degree days, one after the other, week after the week. We're seeing not just a lack of rain, but also the aridification, the drying out of the soil, of the crops that are failing. You can't even put enough water on some crops. It's just too hot for them. And even people who are in the cattle business, they're seeing their cattle just dying in the stockyards. So, I mean, this is an extreme situation.
Yes, and you know what I've seen before. I was working in the water arena in 2011, and you know the canaries in the coal mine are what's your current wildfire situation, as well as what's happening to your agricultural sector, and both of these canaries or warning lights are blinking red for Texas right now. Let's look at wildfires. I mean, the state's wildfire season began exceptionally early this year. We had significantly large wildfires in March. There was the Eastland Complex fire, which burned thousands of acres and also threatened some towns. But even more recently, as early as July, you know, the heat and the dry conditions contributed to hundreds of wildfires that were sparked by fireworks across the state this year. And even right now, we've heard of the Glen Rose fire that is raging in north central Texas, which is certainly being accelerated by the fact that it's extraordinarily hot and it's been very dry due to the drought. So we're seeing, you know, the state's wildfire risk being relatively elevated for this year. And when we look at the Ketch Bynum Drought Index that's maintained by Texas A&M University, right now a lot of the state is at a high risk for fire danger.
As a reporter, covering drought is a difficult thing to do. You can tell people it's dry and it's hot and we need rain, and there's really not much you can do about that. Is to wait for rain to come. But I'm thinking that this is different. We need to alert the public, not just to the wildfire dangers, but also to, you know, conserve water where you can. But telling people, you know, that water supplies are dwindling, communities are getting nervous, and whether or not we are doing policy in a way that's going to address the new reality, in if this is the new reality, if this is just one of those weird summers where it's extremely bad. But it seems like there's too much at risk. I mean, shouldn't we take this at face? Shouldn't we see what's going on around us and say, this needs to be addressed?
Yes. I think what we need to do as a state when we think about drought is we need to remember that droughts can be longer and more worse than what we endure in 1 year. The state's worst drought during recorded time occurred during the 1950s, and this was a 7 to 8 year long drought that left a lasting cultural and economic impact in the state. But when we look at historic records before meteorological records began in the late 19th century, we know that Texas endured droughts that were longer and more severe than the drought of record during the 1950s. There was a mega drought that hit Texas during the time just after the Texas Revolution, up to the Civil War. In the early 18th century, when Spanish authorities established a colony in San Antonio, there was an exceptionally long and severe mega drought. And then there was the southwestern mega drought of the 1500s that lasted 50 or 60 years and had profound impacts on civilizations in the American Southwest. I say that to point that, you know, drought can be, you know, what you see now is certainly bad now, but there's a potential for it to be longer and more severe than what we've seen in the immediate past or what we're enduring now. We don't know how long this drought can last, which is We don't have that fortune-telling capacity here at Texas 2036. But we do know, as we look at historic records, these droughts can be longer. Moreover, we recently partnered with the Office of the State Climatologist at Texas A&M to perform a study of extreme weather trends in Texas between now and year 2036. What that report found was that over the next 15 years, between now and 2036, our average temperature is going to go up 3 degrees Fahrenheit. In the meantime, the amount of rainfall variability we can expect is going to increase, which means that there are going to be some days with a lot more rain than usual and a lot more days with less rain than usual. Combined, these two elements are going to contribute to increased drought severity in the next 15 years. So looking forward, we can expect it not only to be hotter, but we can also expect the droughts to be longer and more severe compared to what they are now.
Jeremy B. Mazur is a senior policy advisor for the nonprofit Texas 2036. Climate scientists report that we're now living in man-made climate change, and it's only going to get worse, especially if we keep pumping carbon into the atmosphere with our fossil fuel-dependent economy. And this is not a popular message in areas where the fossil fuel-dependent economy creates a lot of jobs, like in the Coastal Bend area of Texas. But that's not stopping Maclovio Perez from his tough talk about climate change as he runs for Congress there. Many people in San Antonio and Corpus Christi might remember Mac from his many years of being a popular TV weatherman. Perez won the Democratic nomination for Congress in the 27th District of Texas. He will challenge the Republican incumbent Michael Cloud. We reached out to Cloud and we didn't hear back from his office, but the invitation to come on and discuss his position on climate change remains open. I asked Perez why climate change is so important to him and his campaign.
Well, I've been talking about climate change for about 25 years, so I'm pretty much up to speed on the topic. I've been presenting and lecturing it for many years. There's a lot of young people that I managed to get to who now are following up on that. So it's just kind of a growing movement. But, you know, for 35 years, we've been up against a lot of big money that has been trying to avoid the issue and confound the issue and then question the science and all that. And so that's what we've been up against. And that's who's winning. Now, 30 years later, people are realizing, hey, maybe there's something to this thing. You know, it's getting awfully warm here. And this year has been the year that the chickens have come home to roost, because not only is Texas under the gun, so is all of the breadbasket of America, which is Kansas and Nebraska. They're under incredible stress. Not only, of course, the cattle that died of heat exposure, but also the crops are absolutely ruined up there. So, you know, the concern is the following. You know, in meteorology, you need three data points. You need yesterday and the day before. And then you need that third data point so you can graph a trend, right? And now the trend is like it's unavoidable. And people are looking around going, what are we going to do? And I'm going, well, we sort of should have started 30 years ago. But there's a few moments left before we actually ruin the entire planet.
When you became a weathercaster working in Corpus Christi, the discussion on air about climate change, or as we called it at the time, greenhouse effect.
Yeah. But
I remember you telling a story that wasn't welcomed by the news director.
Oh, no. I've gotten in trouble many times in my career. And one of them was a news director. I said, folks, it's going to take a small tropical storm to actually help us refill our water supply. And the guy comes in, you can't say we need a tropical storm. Why not? The old timers know that. And then I said, well, you know, about climate change, la, la, la. And they're like, well, you can't just blame it on one industry. And I'm going, maybe you should come sit in on my lecture, sir, because, you know, I have a PowerPoint that I've done probably, I don't know, 30 times. We have documentation of a scientist at Exxon in 1978 who wrote a 15-page dissertation on, hey, guys, we're going to have to change our ways, or we're going to have to be there in the writing of the new legislation, because at this point in time, this is not sustainable. And that was in 78. Being in the news business, I had a chance to interview a lot of people. And one of the greatest moments of my life, now that I, in retrospect, realize it, I was speaking to the scientists at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, who wound up putting a sensor at the top of Mauna Loa, Hawaii. And that is the basis of all of the carbon dioxide numbers that we watch, because A, it's out in the middle of the Pacific, B, it's up at 12,000 feet, and C, it's been consistently taking measurements since 1962. And I interviewed the guy in 1976. So it was at that time, we're going, hey, this is going to be a wonderful database for us to use. And it has become the standard. So, yeah, I've been in trouble. Now, in fact, every time I do the presentation on climate change, and I go from the beginning to the middle to where we are, and the solutions that it's going to take are so simple. You know, they're really, really simple. And every time I think somebody's going to start throwing tomatoes at me, but by the time I finish, everybody just sort of sneaks out the back door and doesn't say anything, because we have documentation that proves that, you know, several large oil companies paid money to the American petroleum industry, who then turned it around and gave it to ad agencies to foment confusion, right? Not to mention the PACs that are giving money to many of our legislators. I think most of America is today realizing that something's happening, and I think most of America is ready to do something, but the bottleneck is in the Congress, where there's just too many senators that are, you know, part of the group and will not allow anything to pass through until the moment comes when they can't breathe, you know. And I say, nobody worries about the forest fire until their house burns down, right? And so until it affects them personally, or they get sick, or they get emphysema, or, you know, bronchial asthma or something like that, they're not going to take it seriously. But even then, you know, we're fighting billions of dollars in profits every year. And every year that the fossil fuels industry pushes us back, it's another billion that they made. You know, and in this moment where we are right now, where record high prices and record high profits, you know, my question is, well, how many billions do you really need? You know, I mean, okay, you got to keep your stockholders happy. Guess what? I'm an Exxon stockholder. How about that? I'm fine. You know, if you lowered your profit margin slightly, I think I'd be fine. I'm not going to have a problem. And here's my favorite story. If I had a chance to go talk to Mr. Exxon, I would drive up and say, Mr. Exxon, how are you, sir? You know, I just drove up here from the coastal bend, and I saw 1,000 windmills, and they were churning around making electricity. Isn't that amazing? And then when I got to your parking lot, I saw this absolutely gorgeous red Tesla car, and they told me that it runs on electricity. My question to you, sir, is, are we investing into those modes of energy, or are all of our eggs in one basket? Okay? My point is that if Exxon, Mobil, Phillips, Texaco, who has ever out there, there's only five big corporations, if they really want to be in the energy business, they have to be leading in the diversification, because they've known for 30 years that this is not sustainable. And here it is, a summer of our discontent. Of course, I'm paraphrasing Shakespeare there, of absolutely horrendous record-breaking temperatures, not only here in our backyard, but all the way up to the Midwest.
The Biden administration is proposing massive wind turbines, offshore wind farms in the Gulf of Mexico, as and they want to do this big time. It would produce enough energy to power over 3 million homes. And the Biden administration is really going to, pardon the expression, but they're going to pump the gas on this plan. As a weather expert, person who has been living in the Coastal Bend, looking to represent the Coastal Bend, what does this plan look like to you?
Well, I'm very excited about Mr. Biden's plans. And if I were his little buddy sitting next to him, I'd say, hey, yeah, this oil crisis, you always look for the reverse, right? Gas prices are high. So what do? We double down on the amount of solar panels and we double down on the amount of windmills out there. Okay. And if we do that now in a crisis, we'll go, oh, my utilities went down a little bit. But here's the concern. All of that will have to go through Congress, which provides the money. And I'm running for office in Texas District 27, U.S. House of Representatives, because I want to make sure that we have, you know, some reasonable voices there and say, okay, look, we can't stop oil tomorrow. We know we have to stop it soon. Let's have a plan so we can orderly, easily, with comfort, do the transition as soon as possible. And that's the reality. Think about how fortunate for us that this young man named Elon Musk came along and invented or helped to invent and popularize an electric car. The whole world is going to electric cars. Europe is going, they're not going to allow ICE or internal combustion engines there by 2025.
But GM had an electric car.
Oh, yeah.
EV1.
Yeah, the EV1 in the late 80s, early 90s. And what did they do? They brought them back and they buried them. Why? Because it was working too good. You know? I mean, really, 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 I hate to pick on my friends in the oil business, but it's not my employees in the oil business, the executives in the oil business who are that treacherous enough to say, yeah, this might actually work, so let's just buy it, bury it, and get rid of it. That was what happened to the EV1. I saw many of those driving around in California. Here, you know what I wish they would do? Make an electric pickup truck, right? And don't tell anybody that it's electric. Just tell them that, hey, when you get home at night, just plug this cord into your house electricity and you'll be fine. Oh, okay, fine. That's no problem.
The Ford Lightning is being produced and it's being sold now, although not in the numbers. The demand is incredible for it, which is Ford's F-150, which is an electric truck. And so they're doing it. And it looks just like a F-150. You couldn't tell the difference unless you...
And believe me, I pray for Ford and General Motors. I do. I really, really do. But they're starting today. That means they're 8 years behind the curve, okay? And in eight more years, they're still going to be 8 years behind the curve. The amount of electric cars in China, seeing the Tesla plant up in Austin, the amount of electric cars that come out of that company is going to be staggering. In Europe, they're already converting. I mean, Norway and Denmark, they don't even know what an ICE car looks like anymore.
You are running for Congress, representing the area anchored by Corpus Christi in the Coastal Bend. A lot of oil and natural gas jobs in that area, in the refinery business and also in other parts, in the pulling it out of the ground business. And these are people who they think, well, if we start doing this climate change stuff, this Green New Deal, then I'm going to lose my job. So I'm going to vote with my pocketbook because I'm worried about feeding my family today. And I'm not so much worried about the fact that it's 110 degrees right now. And next summer, you know, we're not going to have anything to eat. So I'm worried about right now. So what do you tell those folks?
Well, it's a very good point, telling them how we need to move, but we don't want to hurt the employment situation. Now, I say, they tell me, oh, you're against oil. So, no, I'm pro oil employees, because oil employees, every time there's a boom, they get hired. They buy a house, they buy a car, and then there's a bust, and they all get fired. I mean, how many times have we seen that? 10. I mean, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. So, you know, I said, look, guys, with all due respect, you oil industry people, you need to also be taking care of yourselves, looking to the future. Now, here's an interesting point. The AFL-CIO, which is, you know, labor, has already done a one-year study and listed out all of the jobs of the future and even has a plan on how to transition those people from one industry to another, which goes back to what I said a moment ago. Big oil needs to diversify and keep those people working and help transition all of us into the future. Why they keep putting all of their resources in one basket is just, I just don't understand it. I just don't understand it. You know, yeah, pretty soon, I mean, in Houston, you can go gas up your car, but you have to wear a mask because you can't breathe the air. So, I mean, places like that. And let's just go back to this one. The Coastal Bend and San Antonio are blessed. We are blessed by the Gulf sea breeze that blows probably 80% of the time and dissipates whatever pollution we make. But don't be confused. We make as much pollution as they do in Houston, but Houston has now overwhelmed the local environment and the ability of the Gulf breeze to blow anything out. That was a problem we had in California. It's basically a bowl. The ocean breeze comes in, floats gently to the inland areas, and brings all the pollution of the big city up to the base of the mountains, San Bernardino, Riverside. So, you know, people are suffering even though you can't see what's in the air. And that's what really bugs the heck out of me. People, if they can't see it, they don't believe it. And I'm going, folks, you're breathing stuff we shouldn't be breathing. And so I challenged the guys, even in the oil business. I said, look, tomorrow morning, go to your garage, fire up your pickup truck, and sit there and read your emails before you leave. And, of course, you wouldn't do that, right? Why? Because there's toxic, noxious gases being emitted out of your tailpipe. And you don't want to breathe that. That could kill you. No. So what happens when you open the garage door? All of those gases go out into the neighborhood, into the environment. Multiply that by the billions and billions of cars coming out of garages every morning. And so we are here at a situation where we need to deal with the reality.
Former TV weathercaster Maclovio Perez is running for Congress in the 27th District of Texas. The Democrat is challenging incumbent Republican Michael Cloud. I reached out to Cloud's office. We haven't heard back, but here's a clip of him speaking on Newsmax discussing his opposition to climate change policy.
You know, this has just never been about the climate. It's all about control of the economy and doing everything we can to depress the productivity of the American worker at the sake of putting together what we now know, you know, they're saying it out loud now, the liberal world order that they're trying to implement. And even if it's on the backs of the American worker, the American family who, like Beth said, is having to make a decision between food and fuel, you know, this is not really what the American president is supposed to be working on, for sure. We should be protecting families. We should be doing everything we can to make the American economy work. And frankly, that's the best thing for the world as well.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. Check out past Texas Matters programs on our website, tpr.org. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.